This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. What kind of person do you consider presidential? A Navy veteran? A Rhodes Scholar? What about a mayor from the Midwest? How about a millennial? Or an openly gay man? And how about a guy with a name that takes some research to pronounce? These attributes describe some of our past presidents, but they all describe one man who's gearing up to run in 2020 as a Democrat. Pete Buttigieg is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, elected at age 29. He's serving a second term now. President Obama once described him as a rising star in the party. His new book is called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. And he joins us now from NPR in New York. Mayor Buttigieg, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts for Mayor Pete Buttigieg. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. First of all, I'm saying it correctly, right? It's Buttigieg, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Okay,
it
good.
Rolls off the tongue, right?
Yeah, it was. Like I said, research. We researched it to make sure that we... And I think this is why you often say you just have people call you Mayor Pete. Is that right?
That's what most people call me back home, yeah.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about your campaign. Let's dive right in. Why should I elect you president?
Well, we're in a moment that calls for, I think, deep change in so many aspects of how our politics and our economics work. And the background that I bring is somebody who has been absorbed for the last 8 years as an executive leader in government, not in Washington, but at the local level, in, by the way, a strong mayor system where you are on the hook for everything from managing wastewater to dealing with a racially sensitive officer-involved shooting. And often it can vary from one minute to the next.
And just to be clear, when you say a strong mayor system, you're talking about an executive mayor system, not just the mayor as the figure head for the city, but basically, literally, the chief executive officer of a city.
Right. For example, in our case, there is no city manager. So there's no one else to call sometimes, and you have to manage these issues. Look, I get that being a mayor is a non-traditional path. A lot of people say, shouldn't you be in Congress first? But for one thing, I don't believe in running for an office so that you could someday run for some other office. I also think that, frankly, what we want to move toward is a world where Congress starts looking more like our best-run cities and towns, not the other way around. I also think there's a lot to be said for executive leadership at a time when we're seeing what happens when you don't have it. I mean, this can sound a little cheeky for me to say as the youngest person in the conversation, but I have more years of government experience under my belt than the president and more years of executive experience under my belt than the vice president, not to mention having more military experience than anyone who's walked into that office on day one since George H.W. Bush. Most of all, I think a relevant experience a highly relevant experience is that of helping guide the transformation of a city in the middle of the so-called Rust Belt at a time when we're being told that communities like mine ought to be looking for greatness in all the wrong places, in resentment, in nostalgia, when our story really is, and I try to tell this in the book, a powerful example of how we can find a better future by looking forward.
I do want to talk more about your experience as the mayor of South Bend. We got some questions to that effect. I'm wondering, before we get to that, what made you decide to run for president as opposed to, say, governor of Indiana or a senator from Indiana? Why president?
Well, again, I don't think you run for an office because you would like to have an office. I think the process of moving toward running for office is about looking at what the office calls for, what it demands, what it requires, and what you bring to the table. When I look at what's happening nationally, I think we need a new generation of leaders to step forward. You know, I belong to the generation that grew up with school shootings as the norm. I was in high school when Columbine happened. I belong to the generation that's going to be paying the bills on things like tax cuts for billionaires, the generation that's going to be on the business end of climate change issues that we're already beginning to experience. You know, three of the last four U.S. presidents, Presidents Clinton, George W. Bush, and Trump, are all the exact same age. They were born within a few weeks of each other in the summer of 1946. So I think coming from a different generation and a different perspective is what we need in our national politics. And you look at the presidency and what it calls for, and I believe that office, like a mayor's office, even though it's a radically different scale, entails three basic functions: implementing good policies, capably running an administration and bringing people together and calling them to their highest values in tough times. I've had to do all of those as mayor. And with all due respect to the United States Congress, you could be a very senior member of the Congress and have never in your life managed more than a few dozen people. I would argue that the kind of experience that some of our best leaders, especially from a new generation, are gathering in local leadership at cities that are maybe the best run level of government that we have left in America are something we should be bringing into our national political dialogue.
With regards to the generation from which you come, and I got your age right, you're 37, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, with regards to your age, that also came up with another person who announced that he would be running for president again today, and that is Bernie Sanders, an independent senator from Vermont. We got several questions about Senator Sanders. Melissa, who's here in D.C., tweeted, "If you're old enough to draw retirement, nope. If you need a staffer to show you how Google works, nope. If you've been in politics for 30 years, you are the establishment." And Aronofsky, who's in Northwood, Iowa, tweeted, "Senator Sanders just announced. In 2000, Pete Buttigieg wrote a paper about his admiration for Sanders' courage. How would he campaign against someone he respects so deeply?" Mayor?
Well, I don't believe in campaigning against other Democrats or other people, I should say, entering the Democratic primary. I believe that there will be competitors more than opponents in this process. And I still, by the way, really admire a lot of things about Senator Sanders, as I did when I wrote that high school essay about then Congressman Sanders back in 2000. In particular, I admired the fact that he talked about what he believed. And I think we need more of that, more people, especially on our side of the aisle, who aren't afraid to talk boldly about progressive solutions. I also am very different. Needless to say, a very different messenger and with a partly different message about where we need to go. I'm not out to dismiss anybody because of their age or their background. I do think we've entered an era where people are a little skeptical about the idea that decades marinating in Washington is automatically a good thing or a qualification for the highest office.
We are speaking to Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. He's a Democrat pursuing a run for president. His new book is called Shortest Way Home. We welcome your questions and thoughts, especially if you are listening from South Bend or Elkhart or Indianapolis or any other part of the state of Indiana or anywhere else in the country with thoughts for Mayor Pete. Email us, 1a@wamu.org. Now, where does this stand right now? Are you a formally declared candidate?
We have launched an exploratory committee. We're using that to gauge support, to see how we're doing on fundraising, to finance early trips to early states like Iowa, New Hampshire, where I've just been. The reception has been terrific, so all of the signs are pointing in the same direction, but we have not formally taken the step of launching a presidential campaign.
When are you going to make up your mind?
As soon as we're ready.
Why not just dive in?
Because there's a process you've got to follow, especially when you're not personally wealthy. So if you're wealthy, and then you can do things like, personally finance all the public opinion research you need and hire an early staff and just pay for it out of your own pocket. I suppose even if I weren't wealthy, but if I were a decades-long senator from a coastal state with a gilded fundraising base, I could do that too. This is a project that is starting from the ground up. It's much more grassroots in nature. And that means that a massive presidential campaign launch and all the factors that go into the decision process for that are not something that I can just have ready and waiting for me years in advance or even months in advance.
There's been an interesting kind of a dance that people do around this time of year. I'm sure you've seen it. You know, they announce either a committee or if they are well enough funded, they just run. They release a book. You released a book, and then they start to make the rounds on NPR and NBC and CBS and everywhere else. You were on The View with the panel on ABC with the five ladies talking about politics and so forth. And so you kind of say, hey, I'm thinking about running, and you get this national attention. And there are a lot of Democrats across the country whose eyes are beginning to cross because it looks like there's about enough Democrats who are running or might run to field not even a football team, like an Olympic delegation. It's becoming this gigantic pool of people.
Yeah,
how do you rise to the top of that pool?
Well, in many ways, I think the fact that the field is so broad tells you something, right? Think about what it means that unlike other years, we don't have one person who's the program and then everybody else decides whether they're going to get on board or go with a sort of rebellion. We don't even have three people or five people who can command a plurality and set the terms of the debate. To me, that's not an accident. It's an indication that we're at a moment of total realignment, and that's leading to a very widespread, very diverse set of people that may not even resolve themselves into lanes for a very long time. I've definitely got the millennial Episcopalian gay war veteran lane all to myself. But
that constituency is a powerful one.
It's a moment, though, that I think is actually highly favorable to newcomers and underdogs. And I'm self-aware enough to know that getting into this process, I would be both of those things, a newcomer and an underdog.
I know we got to pause in just a moment, but do you really want to deal with Washington right now? I mean, is this something you're really eager to deal with, is this swamp that President Trump said that he was going to drain? How do you feel about just stepping foot in Washington?
I want it to change. Look, I think anytime you feel an instinct to offer yourself forward for leadership, it's because you have an idea of how things could be, you see how things are, and you want to change it. That's the discernment process that led me to run for mayor of South Bend. It wasn't that I wanted to be part of municipal government in South Bend as I then saw it. It was that I saw a way to use the tools of government to make the life of our city and the people who lived there better. And we did it. And it was the most uplifting experience. It was rough and tumble. It had incredibly challenging moments that made huge demands, not just on me politically, but as a human being. But through that, I grew, I learned, and I was able to contribute. And I think we need people looking at this national process who have a view of Washington that is radically different than the way Washington works today.
I want to get more into what you learned as mayor of South Bend when we continue our conversation with Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, considering a run for president as a Democrat. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you live in South Bend. Tell us a little something about your mayor that you think the nation should know. 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking with Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, about his new book, Shortest Way Home, and his presidential exploratory committee. We'd love to hear from you. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Nancy wrote on our Facebook page, "I have been very impressed with him and, in fact, just made a contribution to his exploratory committee. I hope he will actually run." Kristen wrote on our Facebook page, "It seems like you've managed to sell progressive ideas in America's heartland, something the Democratic Party has failed to do in recent elections. How have you done it? What can the rest of the party learn from your success in South Bend?" Mayor?
Well, I think for our party to succeed, we need to connect with the middle of the country. I think losing touch with especially the industrial Midwest where I live obviously cost us in a very serious way in 2016. My experience with connecting with conservative and independent voters is a little different than the Democratic playbook that we inherited from the 90s. I think that playbook said that you should look at what the Republicans are doing and sort of be willing to go halfway some of the time and reach people that way. In my experience, voters are not as focused on your ideology, left, right, or center, as they are on your results and your values. And so, you know, when it comes to results, part of how I've been able to attract a lot of Republican and independent support is just by pointing to specifically what happened, how we made things better, keeping score, putting forward numbers, making it as fact-based a conversation as we can in an environment where people can hold you accountable very quickly for good or bad results because they know if a road's getting plowed well or poorly and if a neighborhood is starting to look better or starting to look worse. But the values part is really important, too. I don't believe that appealing to conservatives, if you happen to be more progressive, comes by way of pretending to be more conservative than you really are and tricking them. That certainly is not the approach I followed. What I found is that if you explain how you came by the positions you hold, even somebody who holds different positions, if they understand that you came by it honestly, they may give you the benefit of the doubt on some other things and be able to hear you when you were pointing to areas where there really is common ground. And on issue after issue, we've been able to do that at the local level at a moment when the national conversation seems more and more divorced from reality.
I hate to be the cynical one in the room, but do you honestly think Washington's going to let you have a fact-based conversation right now?
Well, I don't think we should accept the terms of Washington as immutable. I think we need to change them. And there are lots of ways to do this. By the way, this just happened in a really, I would argue, beautiful way. If you contrast the 2010 town halls around Obamacare, and I was a candidate for office in 2010, and it was a rough time to be a Democrat, especially in Indiana. There was talk of death panels. You know, Democrats were getting yelled at for introducing communism to America in the form of the Affordable Care Act. Contrast that with the town halls that began to happen in 2017, when the tide began to turn on Till Healthcare, the very thing that was utterly toxic for our party as an issue in 2010, became arguably the winning issue for our party in 2018. What changed? Well, the law actually went into effect, and we can have a whole conversation about its gaps and its strengths and its weaknesses. But my point is, what you saw in those town halls was real people getting in the faces of their members of Congress, saying, this is what this law means to me. People like my mother-in-law, who relies on insurance she buys through the ACA to get life-saving chemotherapy. And it turns out it's much harder to lie to somebody about their own life, about reality. And so I do think the same fact-based politics that we practice by necessity at the local level can and must be exported to the national level before it's too late.
Give me a little more background on South Bend. I think people who know of South Bend, Indiana, generally know about it because it's that town that's like right next to the University of Notre Dame. But beyond that, South Bend faced a 60-year population decline, 60-year population decline, as I understand it, following industries leaving town, which is not unique to South Bend. And it was a city that needed to do some serious adaptation. Can you give us a sense of something that you did or helped with as mayor in South Bend that might translate for the way you would govern the rest of the country?
Yeah, part of the story that I tell in the book is about how South Bend's trajectory had to change. I think people know about the Notre Dame. They might assume that we were a tidy, wealthy, homogenous college town. We're really not. We were an industry city. Studebaker was a major American company, made cars, until it abruptly shut down in 1963. And the consequence of that was a legacy of shuttered factories and abandoned houses that I didn't even realize as a kid. I didn't understand that that wasn't normal. We just, to us, it was part of the furniture. We're a very racially diverse city. We're 40-45% non-white. We're a largely low-income city. We're celebrating the fact that our per capita income just went north of $20,000 for the first time in a while. And yet, through all these challenges that we faced, even being called a dying city in the national media the month that I got into the race for mayor, we were able to change our trajectory. Some of it was very tactical. We went out and dealt with blight in our neighborhoods, dealt with over 1,000 vacant and abandoned houses in 1,000 days to not only to deal with that problem, but to demonstrate to the city that we could conquer some of our toughest challenges if we had the political will to do it. We've also changed our industry mix. And I want to be clear on this. This is not about choosing between, you know, for example, manufacturing and technology. Manufacturing remains a very important part of our economy, especially advanced manufacturing. But it will never look like it used to. Even when you're producing cars, for example, at the levels that of output that we did in the 60s, you would do it with far fewer people. And so we have to mix in other industries like an emerging data analytics and data center industry that's happening right now in our city on the very acreage where the Studebaker factories once stood, you know, creating good paying jobs in an industry that didn't even exist in our automaking days.
And it is worth noting that some of these new jobs don't require 4, 6, 8 years of college. We did a program early in our life as a show called How to Earn Six Figures Without a College Degree about some of these new jobs that Mayor Pete is talking about. You'll find that program on our website, the1a.org. I do wonder, though, before I get to some more audience comments, I hear you in terms of being a mayor with a series of very obvious problems that everyone gets to see kind of up close because they're all in town and they all had a hand in voting for you. If you come here, you got to deal with 635 members of Congress who may or may not have their own personal imperatives. Of course, they all have their own personal imperatives, which is getting reelected, plus a multi-billion dollar industry of think tanks and influence groups, plus the DC media establishment, plus. There is no way that you're going to be able to get practical solutions done as easily in this small town as you've gotten them done in your small town. How do you adapt?
Well, Nobody walks into that office with total mastery of the ways of Washington. I guess what I'm proposing is that somebody who has solved problems in a different with a different framework for problem solving can introduce that in some different ways. Look, to some extent, Washington is about power. And in America, power is supposed to come from the people. One of the reasons that the Washington machinery, and in particular the United States Congress, repeatedly produces outcomes that are completely divorced from what the American people want to see is that our democracy itself needs a tune-up. And so I think the next president has to lead a process where we make our democracy, frankly, more democratic. And that goes to everything from the role of money in politics to the fact that districts are drawn to where members of Congress are choosing their voters instead of the other way around, to things that get talked about far less but are very important for the democratic character of our country, from things like statehood and political representation for D.C., for political representation for Puerto Rico.
Are you in favor of political representation for D.C. and Puerto Rico?
Yes, I believe D.C. ought to be a state. The Puerto Rican situation is a little more complicated because that really needs to be up to Puerto Ricans, but I believe we should welcome them as a state if they make that choice. And regardless, I think they should have a voice in the presidential election process, because I think things like the aftermath of the storm would not have happened if there were more of a political consequence to leaving our fellow U.S. citizens in the lurch that way. By the way, I also think we got to take a look at the Electoral College.
I was just going to ask you about that.
I mean, this body, twice in my at my tender age, twice in my lifetime, I have seen this body overturn the will of the American people. One of the few convincing justifications that used to be offered for the Electoral College was that it could step in and prevent somebody manifestly unfit from the office for ever getting into it. I'll leave people to their own decision-making about whether it's met that mission. And if I live in Indiana, as somebody who lives in Indiana, you know, most cycles, I have no voice in the Electoral College. I might as well be in Puerto Rico because we're not the kind of swing state that gets all the attention. So we've got to revisit just how democratic we are. Otherwise, my generation might be the first in American history to see us backslide on democracy. You know, it used to be that every turn of the wheel in U.S. history saw America become a little more democratic. More, it was lurching and it was imperfect, but from extending the vote beyond property owners to direct election of senators to women's suffrage and voting rights for minorities, we moved in the right direction, and now that's backsliding. More restrictions are being invented that make it harder for legitimate U.S. citizens to vote, and we feel like a less and less democratic country by the year. We've even been downgraded by the Freedom House rankings of what countries are most free and democratic around the world.
All right, let's get into some nitty-gritty questions from our listeners and also some comments as we continue our conversation with South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Natalie emailed, I work for a small business in Elkhart, Indiana. Elkhart's about 15 right. miles east of South Bend. Pete understands the dynamics of small hometown companies' uphill climb in the corporate world. He is a champion for hometown values. Got a lot of questions about your policy views, and clearly there are lots of candidates staking lots of different claims on their various policy views. Let me play a quick mashup of two candidates, two senators, Kamala Harris of California and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Here is a piece from Kamala Harris's official presidential announcement in Oakland, California, and Elizabeth Warren's announcement in Lawrence, Massachusetts.
I am running to declare once and for all that health care is a fundamental right. And we will deliver that right with Medicare for all.
Corruption is a cancer on our democracy.
Yes, it is.
And we will get rid of it only with strong medicine, with real structural reform. And I want to be crystal clear about exactly what I mean when I say that. First, we need to change the rules to clean up Washington, end the corruption.
So those were Senators Elizabeth Warren in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and Kamala Harris in Oakland, California. If you could boil down the core, the largest part of your platform, Mayor Buttigieg, into one word, what would that one word be?
Freedom. I believe that Democrats need to get back in the business of talking about freedom. We have for decades allowed conservatives to monopolize the discussion as if they were the only ones who cared about it. They care about freedom, but in a very specific way. They think about freedom from. It's freedom from taxation, freedom from regulation, freedom from government, all of which can be very important. But when I think about the freedoms that have really impacted my well-being and that of the community I live in, I think about freedom too. And I think about the freedom to, for example, start a small business, which is not available to you if leaving your other job means you'd lose your health care. I think about the freedom to marry, a freedom that only came into my life by the grace of a single vote on the U.S. Supreme Court. And yet, in terms of my life, is arguably the most important freedom that I've ever been able to enjoy. I think about the freedoms that could come from releasing the pressure of student debt on my generation. I think about the fact that you are not free if you are prevented from suing a bank or a credit card company, even after they get caught ripping you off. So I think we need a more robust conversation about what freedom looks like. And I think if you look at freedom in a big picture sense, it actually points you in a very progressive direction.
Before we get back to talking policy, are you prepared for the reality that some people who like your platform will not vote for you simply because you're gay?
That would be unfortunate. But, you know, there's only one way to find out for sure the extent to which that's going to happen. You know, we worried about that at home. When I came out, when I reached the point in my personal life where I felt that it was time, inconveniently, I was in the middle of a reelection campaign. And Mike Pence was the governor of my state at the time. It was not obvious what the consequences would be or whether I could survive. I wound up getting reelected with 80% of the vote. And to me, that's an indication that there are enough people in our socially conservative community that either supported me in coming out or simply didn't care as long as we were doing a good job of moving the city forward. My hope is that the same is true nationally, but I'm under no illusion at a moment when we don't even have an Equality Act that can protect all Americans from being fired for being gay. At a moment when the president seems to think it's okay to pick on trans people for political gain, I'm under no illusion that we are there yet when it comes to equality.
But you know, this is exactly what some Republicans are going to point to and say, see, the Democrats are all about identity politics. They want to focus on the fact that, oh, we've got a biracial black woman running, and we've got all these women running, and we've got a gay guy running. Like, they're so focused on identity politics, they're not paying attention to the issues that really matter to you, your pocketbook, your family, the security of the nation. This is typical Democratic talking points writ large.
Yeah, again, the value I want to put at the center of the conversation is freedom and what it actually means in our everyday lives to exercise and safeguard those freedoms. If someone on the Republican side objects to identity politics, then they should question why their party nominated somebody who designed his candidacy around white identity politics, whose function was to essentially divide middle class and working class people against one another over race.
Let me get to a few policy questions. I know we got to pause in a minute, and I promise we'll focus on listener questions for the rest of the hour. Helen emailed a multi-part question with several policy questions.
Uh-oh.
We'll try to go through them one at a time. Helen asks, does he believe that health care is a human right?
So the answer is yes. I do want to say, as these policy questions come and as we take them, I'm a little nervous that our party has gone right to policies, right into the 14-point plan and the detailed PowerPoints, and have been arguing policy at a time when we've been kind of left behind because the right, very with a lot of discipline and cleverness, argued philosophy and moved the entire values framework of the country to the right. But Helen's first part of that question to me is a philosophical one, and I believe the answer is yes.
Yeah, I will grant you that on the 14-point plan. Simon Sinek once said Martin Luther King Jr. gave the I Have a Dream speech, not the I Have a Plan speech.
Right.
Helen also asks, does he believe women should be treated like adults who can make their own reproductive decisions?
Yes. And look, I am from Indiana. I hold office in South Bend. So as you might imagine, I have friends and I have supporters who do not view this issue the same way I do. But I believe that this is one of the most painful and personal sets of decisions that a person can face, a woman's decisions around reproductive health. And to me, the last thing she needs is a male politician like me imposing boundaries that might even be politically motivated on her healthcare choices.
We'll get to more of Helen's policy questions in a moment. And speaking of men making decisions for women, Indy KJ Sharp in Indianapolis, Indiana, tweeted, "I love Mayor Pete, but this is the year of the woman." Love to get your sense on how many female candidates are running and whether or not indeed America is ready for a woman to be president and might make up its mind based on that. We'll get to that in just a minute. Stay close. We'll continue in a moment after a quick heads up about tomorrow's program. Hair can be a touchy subject, especially if someone touches your hair without asking. But these days, it's touching a nerve on the job, with some workers getting fired over their hairstyles. New York is considering a law to prevent this. If your hair has become an issue on your job to the point that it threatened your job, how did you handle it? And how would you describe your hairstyle? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Now, to be clear, we're not talking about something like refusing to wear a hairnet in a restaurant kitchen. That's a whole nother matter. Is your hairstyle anyone's business but your own? Share your story, 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. We'll share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. We'll get to as many questions of yours as we can in the time we have left, 1A@WAMU.org. Let's keep going with Helen's list of questions, and then we'll keep going with some more. Helen also asks, does he believe in stronger control of access to guns?
Yes, the worst part of my job as mayor is getting the call about a victim of gun violence, and far too many of them are also young. We haven't had the kind of, thank God, the kind of headline-grabbing mass shootings that some communities have, but you know, with much less attention, there's still been so much heartbreak in our community. And that's true of every urban community. And when we fight it, I feel like I have one hand tied behind my back because the state of Indiana won't let cities do much. Now, to be clear, we don't take that as an excuse. We've worked very hard on an anti-violence strategy that I believe to be very effective called a group violence intervention. But I also believe that it is totally compatible with the Second Amendment for us also to have some common sense measures to keep people safe. Things like universal background checks, which again, to me, is an excellent illustration of what's broken in our democracy. Because if a policy enjoys support from 80 or by some measures even 90% of the American people, including most gun owners, including most Republicans, and yet Washington still can't get it done, that tells you that something is warping the extent to which Washington can respond to the will of the American people. But yeah, and look, Indiana's not a place where it's very popular to weigh in on gun policy. But I talk about my experience as a mayor getting that call. I talk about swearing in police officers with their spouses at their side and not wanting to see them outgunned. And I talk about the fact that it was my responsibility to carry a pistol and a rifle around in uniform in Afghanistan. And there are some weapons of war that just have no place on the streets of an American community in peacetime.
What do you think about banning assault weapons?
I think we've got to draw the line somewhere. And so I think
I'd say that knowing that they're, you know, the definition of what an assault weapon is up to debate. But broadly speaking, assault type weapons.
Yeah, I mean, we can have that debate. And for example, there's some differences between an M4 that I carried and a AR-15, but they're not, in many ways not that different. I think philosophically, the issue is we have to acknowledge that somewhere in between a slingshot and a nuclear weapon, we have to draw a line. And the fact that you can't have a nuclear weapon shows that the answer to, you know, what restrictions are compatible with the Second Amendment is not zero. Okay? Not every common sense rule amounts to an infringement. The question is where you draw that line, and I think we can have an adult conversation as a country that will include looking at some assault weapons, weapons of war, mm-hmm. that are not making our neighborhoods safer, and they're not necessarily covered by the Second Amendment.
Are you a gun owner now?
The guns that I collected came home from Afghanistan. They're antiques. I suppose they are rifles, but you wouldn't want to fire one. It would probably explode.
Max tweeted, wondering what Mayor Pete believes a progressive foreign policy looks like, since there doesn't seem to be much of a consensus or talk about foreign policy at all among those running. That's another interesting tie to Bernie Sanders. He's done a lot more to improve his foreign policy bona fides from when he ran in 2016. You have a military career. You were a Naval Reserve officer who I believe specialized in counterterrorism and were deployed to Afghanistan in 2013. I wonder where you see your focus in terms of foreign policy as president, including America's longest war, and what needs to be done to get out of there in something that resembles victory, whatever victory might mean.
Yeah, obviously I've reflected a lot on this as somebody who served in that conflict. First of all, America today, in my view, does not have a foreign policy, and that is a very dangerous thing. It's also safe to say the American left has struggled to articulate its foreign policy ever since it sort of got scrambled by the neoconservative moment of the first part of this century. I think that we need to be much clearer on the threshold for the commitment of force. And we also need anybody who wants to be the next president needs to discuss how we're going to regain credibility in the international space, even knowing that there's probably no going back to exactly the world order that we used to know. But I think every decision we make needs to be, number one, grounded in American interests. Number two, tested for compatibility with American values, including democracy and human rights. And number three, vet it whenever possible with American allies, because we are not operating in a vacuum. And we are quickly, I mean, just look at the isolation of the U.S. at the Munich Security Conference. And what you see is that America, so-called America First, has very quickly turned into America Alone. And that puts U.S. lives at risk. We need to be a credible country that keeps its word in a way that both our allies and our enemies know. When it comes to Afghanistan, you could be old enough to enlist now and not have even been alive when 9/11 took place. It is crazy that we are operating all over the world on an authorization for the use of military force that dates back to dealing with 9/11. It shows that Congress has abdicated its war powers in many ways. Honestly, I think when it comes to Afghanistan, it's not a question of whether we're getting out. We are getting out. The question is whether we do it well or poorly. And I'm concerned about doing it by tweet, surprising our own military and intelligence leaders with policymaking over Twitter. I'm concerned about the fact that the Afghan government seems to be, from what I can tell, is being left on the sidelines of the engagement with the Taliban that's going on right now in Doha. But I will say that we are leaving, and we need to make sure that we leave well, because we have to put an end to endless war.
Suppose you win the presidency, and 2021, when you take the oath of office, you get to the White House, and the border wall is still in some form being built. What do you do?
I don't think the border wall is the priority for U.S. security. Frankly, I don't even think it's the priority for border security. I care a lot about border security, and I recognize the complexity of it. There's a lot more to border security than putting up a wall from sea to shining sea. By the way, there's also a lot more to security for Americans than border security or anything touched by the military that I worked on when I was in uniform.
I'll grant you that. But I mean, if there is even part of the border wall being built, say the court battles go in President Trump's favor, some of the wall, those 55 miles that the current funding would fund, are being built at the time when you take office. What do you do? Do you tear them down? Do you let them finish being built? Do you try to move the money to something else? What's the plan?
I mean, it's hard for me to picture the hypothetical without knowing exactly where we're going to get. But what I will say is, look, borders can have fencing or a wall. That's part of borders. It's not some kind of absolute philosophical opposition to the idea that we would ever put up a barrier along our border. It's a question of what actually works, which is not as simple as a barrier. And also, what is our priority? Are we really talking about taking money from military construction that will go to housing for military families and rerouting it to a wall that probably won't work? That is a huge mistake in terms of priorities. It also is a huge misuse of emergency authority at a moment when real live emergencies, including a mounting slow motion climate emergency, should be commanding dramatically more attention than they're getting from the administration. And in my view, that's security, too.
Yeah, George emailed, "Ask Mayor Pete, what will you do about climate change?"
So to me, climate change is personal. It's part of what I talk about when I say that we need to have a more reality-based and ground-based conversation. I know that on television, when climate change is being discussed, it cuts to the B-roll of pieces of ice falling off in the Antarctic and polar bears and pine trees. And what I picture in my head when I think about climate is standing on the porch of a family on Frederickson Street in South Bend, Indiana, when we had a historic flood. And it was the day before the first day of school, and they're wondering what they're supposed to do because their bedrooms of their children in the basement are flooded. We were told that was a 1,000-year rainfall. 18 months later, I'm right back in the emergency operations center of our city for what we were told was a 500-year flood. This isn't a theoretical problem. This problem is upon us right now. It's why the Green New Deal, which, let's be honest, is more a set of goals in its current iteration than it is a fully designed plan. But the Green New Deal gets right that this truly is a national emergency whose destructive power is on par with a Great Depression or a World War and therefore requires a commensurate level of effort, which, by the way, and this is the other insight of the Green New Deal, could mean good things for our national economy.
So what do we do to whip enough votes in Congress into shape to get members of Congress to go along with something, anything, one thing about climate change? Or do you do this through your executive power as president and say, to heck with Congress, I'm never going to hurt all those cats, I can do this myself?
I'd rather do this with Congress than around Congress. And I believe that, again, if our democracy is functioning properly, there will be more and more pressure on Congress to do something. Because what we have right now is not a contest of ideas on what to do about climate change. It's a contest between one group that's put forward at least the outlines of a proposal to deal with this massive, imminent, real threat, and the other side that seems to prefer to pretend that that threat does not even exist. That's the frightening thing. It's not that we're having a struggle over how to meet this challenge. It's that there are many people, adults with college degrees in positions of responsibility in the U.S. Congress, who seem to believe either that it's not real or that we can somehow get away with doing nothing about it. And I think that's part of the short-term thinking that my generation needs to stand up and respond to. Because when I think about the world in 2054, when I reach the current age of the current president, these issues will all have come due. And so it's not a theoretical question, and it's not somebody else's problem.
So give me one specific policy that you would try to rally support around if you were president for climate change.
Well, one thing we clearly got to do is we got to mobilize higher level of R&D in order to bend the cost curve on solar PV technology. As we speak in South Bend, we're partnering with Habitat for Humanity to build homes that are themselves net zero energy. And I think when we talk about energy independence, we should think about what it takes to deliver that not only at the national level, but at the individual or family level. So look, that's just one element of
More research on solar technology, for example, to try to move that
along. We should be putting billions into R&D to change the cost of renewables technology. We also need to be serious about carbon emissions. We need to be serious about the power mix. And we need to invest in the ways that our communities and cities are built so that they're more carbon efficient.
A few more quick questions before we got to let you go. One area that I really got furious about in the last campaign that nobody bothered to ask anybody about through pretty much the entire debate process was education. What's at the top of your list for improving education in this country? No one ever asks about it, and it makes me crazy.
Yeah, it's so important. You could
What's
argue
your top priority, your top policy priority for education?
My top priority is the teaching profession. And maybe this just reflects the fact that I married a teacher and I've learned a lot about what it's like to be in that profession. You know, there are many societies where, in terms of prestige and in terms of compensation, it is well understood that professionals in that field are in their importance and significance and rigor on a par with people in the medical profession or the legal profession. It is no less important. And yet, we relegate teachers to a different status. Now, there are all kinds of things beyond that that we need to do in terms of policy, flexibility, curriculum, resources, pre-K. But I really think that we're at a moment that requires us as a society to treat, including with compensation, but also with professional development and the rigors that surround the profession, mm-hmm. To treat teaching as important as it truly is. Because if you look at the numbers, you look at the difference that having one of the best teachers can make in somebody's earning power versus not being able to access good teaching.
For sure.
And it is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, sometimes per child.
Let me get back to Indy KJ Sharp's point. Indy KJ Sharp in Indianapolis tweeted, "I love Mayor Pete, but this is the year of the woman." What do you make of that?
You know, I love the fact that there are women who are stepping forward in so many ways for so many offices, not just the fact that we have the most serious presidential candidates who are women in the debate right now for 2020, but also the fact that Congress, including a number of candidates that I supported in 2018 and tried to do everything I could to help, who are now among the freshman class in Congress, many of the even younger than I am, some of whom are really leading the debate in the U.S. So, you know, in order to improve gender representation at the local level, I've worked to make sure that we have women in positions of responsibility, including the majority of people in senior positions on my staff, positions that had never had a woman before in terms of departmental leadership in the cabinet. And I think we need to do the same thing at the national level.
Last policy question, right quick. Justin in D.C. tweeted, "Can you ask him about his thoughts on the financial crisis now that we're 10 years out, as well as how he would approach regulating the financial industry?"
Well, what's clear is that the financial industry is not just going to self-regulate and do the right thing on their own. It's one of the reasons why the gutting of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a major problem. But also going beyond consumer banking and retail banking, it's also clear that some of the problems that led to the financial crash last time have still not been fully corrected or addressed. We need to have a level playing field. And it's only going to get more difficult as some of these financial transactions become so complex and so abstruse that even the people practicing them may not fully understand their implications. Now, you can't regulate. Sometimes regulators don't understand either, so we got to be smart about what we're doing. But there's no question that we need to be more assertive in ensuring that the public interest is met through regulation. And not trusting that financial institutions left to their own devices are simply going to do the right thing all or most of the time.
Last question briefly before I let you go. You ready to deal with Donald Trump in the general election?
Yeah, I grew up in Indiana and I'm gay. I'm comfortable dealing with bullies. And I also think that, frankly, we need to look past Donald Trump. I get that when he does something wrong, it needs to be confronted. When he says something false, it needs to be corrected. But you know, I think every Democrat has probably fantasized about what they would say to him on a debate stage. Imagine some devastating zinger that you mm-hmm. want to serve up to this president. But when you think like that, it becomes almost like he's the one you're trying to impress. I'm worried about what the world is going to look like in 2030, 2040, 2050. This president's going to come and go, and we need a message that's not about him, but about us.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. His new book is called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. Mr. Mayor, Godspeed on the campaign trail, and thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
This show was produced by Bianca Martin. You can learn more about her at the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.